Welcome to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. How exciting is this? What an adventure to be embarking on together. In this podcast, we will be riding along with the subreddit A Year of War and Peace, which is a Reddit community of around 2,000 people who are all reading War and Peace this year, one chapter per day. Now, because we'll all be reading the same chapter on the same day, there'll be a discussion thread about that chapter where experts and amateurs alike discuss the chapter and figure out exactly what it meant. I think this is such a cool way to experience this book. Now, I've never read War and Peace, so I'm actually really happy to have this opportunity to sort of have the book explained to me one chapter at a time over the course of a year. And as I'm wrapping my head around the book, hopefully it will be entertaining, and so too will you wrap your head around this great book. If you're not already a member of the subreddit community, A Year of War and Peace, pop over to Reddit, and that's where the conversation's at. All of the knowledge that I share with you during this podcast is going to be derived from comments and links on that subreddit. The structure of this podcast will be, every day I'll read you a chapter of the book, audiobook style, and then that will be followed by a discussion about that chapter where we clarify, analyze, and kind of unpack the chapter, making sure nothing went over our heads. The reading section of the podcast should only be probably about 10 minutes per episode, because it turns out that the average chapter length in this book is only 4 pages. That's not a really long chapter. That's about 10 to 15 minutes of reading. The very longest chapter in the book is 11 pages. So that's a good thing. It seems like the podcast will be more analysis and discussion than audiobook. But hey, if you tune in for a whole year, you will hear the whole audiobook of War and Peace, which is pretty damn cool. Now, with no further ado, I think we should get into this book and start reading this epic, Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. Book 1, Chapter 1. Well, Prince, so Genoa and Lucca are now just family estates of the Bonapartes. But I warn you, if you don't tell me that this means war, if you still try to defend the infamies and horrors perpetuated by the Antichrist, I really believe he is Antichrist, I will have nothing more to do with you, and you are no longer my friend, no longer my faithful slave, as you call yourself. But how do you do? I see I've frightened you. Sit down and tell me the news. It was in July 1805, and the speaker was the well-known Anna Pavlovna Scherer, maid of honour and favourite of the Empress Maria Fedorovna. With these words she greeted Prince Vasily, a man of high rank and importance, who was the first to arrive at her reception. Anna Pavlovna had had a cough for some days. She was, as she said, suffering from la grippe, grippe being then a new word in St. Petersburg, used only by the elite. All her invitations, without exception, written in French and delivered by a scarlet-liveried footman that morning, ran as follows. If you have nothing better to do, count or prince, and if the prospect of spending an evening with a poor invalid is not too terrible, I shall be very charmed to see you tonight between 7 and 10. Annette Scherer.
Heavens, what a virulent attack, replied the prince, not in the least disconcerted by this reception. He had just entered, wearing an embroidered court uniform, knee breeches and shoes, and had stars on his breast and a serene expression on his flat face. He spoke in that refined French in which our grandfathers not only spoke but thought, and with the gentle, patronizing intonation natural to a man of importance who had grown old in society and at court. He went up to Anna Pavlovna, kissed her hand, presenting to her his bald, scented, and shining head, and complacently seated himself on the sofa.
First of all, dear friend, tell me how you are. Set your friend's mind at rest, said he, without altering his tone, beneath the politeness and affected sympathy of which indifference and even irony could be discerned. Can one be well while suffering morally? Can one be calm in times like these if one has any feeling? Said Anna Pavlovna. You are staying the whole evening, I hope.
And the fete at the English ambassador's. Today is Wednesday. I must put in an appearance there, said the prince.
My daughter is coming for me to take me there.
I thought today's fete had been cancelled. I confess, all these festivities and fireworks are becoming wearisome.
If they had known that you wished it, the entertainment would have been put off, said the prince, who, like a wound-up clock, by force of habit, said things he did not even wish to be believed.
Don't tease.
Well, and what has been decided about Novosiltsev's dispatch?
You know everything.
What can one say about it? Replied the prince in a cold, listless tone.
What has been decided? They have decided that Bonaparte has burnt his boats, and I believe that we are ready to burn ours.
Prince Vasily always spoke languidly, like an actor repeating a stale part. Anna Pavlovna Scherer, on the contrary, despite her 40 years, overflowed with animation and impulsiveness. To be an enthusiast had become her social vocation, and sometimes, even when she did not feel like it, she became enthusiastic in order not to disappoint the expectations of those who knew her. The subdued smile, which, though it did not suit her faded features, always played around her lips, expressed, as in a spoilt child, a continual consciousness of her charming defect, which she neither wished, nor could, nor considered it necessary to correct. In the midst of a conversation on political matters, Anna Pavlovna burst out, "Oh, don't speak to me of Austria. Perhaps I don't understand things, but Austria never has wished and does not wish for war. She is betraying us. Russia alone must save Europe. Our gracious sovereign recognizes his high vocation and will be true to it. That is the one thing I have faith in. Our good and wonderful sovereign has to perform the noblest role on earth, and he is so virtuous and noble that God will not forsake him. He will fulfill his vocation and crush the hydra of revolution, which has become more terrible than ever in the person of this murderer and villain. We alone must avenge the blood of the just one. Whom, I ask you, can we rely on? England, with her commercial spirit, will not and cannot understand the Emperor Alexander's loftiness of soul. She has refused to evacuate Malta. She wanted to find, and still seeks, some secret motive in our actions. What answer did Novosiltsev get?
None. The English have not understood and cannot understand the self-abnegation of our Emperor, who wants nothing for himself, but only desires the good of mankind.
And what have they promised?
Nothing.
And what little they have promised, they will not perform.
Prussia has always declared that Bonaparte is invincible and that all Europe is powerless before him,
and I don't believe a word that Hardenberg says, or Haugwitz either.
This famous Prussian neutrality is just a trap. I have faith only in God and the lofty destiny of our adored monarch. He will save Europe.
She suddenly paused, smiling at her own impetuosity.
I think, said the prince with a smile, that if you had been sent instead of our dear wincing Gerard, you would have captured the King of Prussia's consent by assault. You are so eloquent. Will you give me a cup of tea?
In a moment. Apropos, she added, becoming calm again. I am expecting two very interesting men tonight. Le Vicomte de Mortemart.
Vicomte means nobleman.
Who is connected with the Montmorencys through the Rohans, one of the best French families. He is one of the genuine émigrés.
The good ones. Émigrés are French people that fled France in opposition of the French Revolution in the late 1700s.
He is one of the genuine émigrés, the good ones, and also the Abbé Morieux.
Abbé means clergyman.
Do you know that profound thinker? He has been received by the Emperor. Had you heard?
I shall be delighted to meet them, said the prince. But tell me, he added with studied carelessness, as if it had only just occurred to him, though the question he was about to ask was the chief motive of his visit. Is it true that the Dowager Empress wants Baron Funk to be appointed first secretary in Vienna? The Baron, by all accounts, is a poor creature.
Prince Vasily wished to obtain this post for his son, but others were trying, through the Dowager Empress Maria Fedorovna, to secure it for the Baron.
Anna Pavlovna almost closed her eyes to indicate that she, nor anyone else, had any right to criticize what the Empress desired or was pleased with.
Baron Funk has been recommended to the Dowager Empress by her sister,
was all she said, in a dry and mournful tone. As she named the Empress, Anna Pavlovna's face suddenly assumed an expression of profound and sincere devotion and respect, mingled with sadness, and this occurred every time she mentioned her illustrious patroness. She added that Her Majesty had deigned to show Baron Funk beaucoup d'estime, which means high esteem, and again her face clouded over with sadness. The prince was silent and looked indifferent. But with the womanly and courtier-like quickness and tact habitual to her, Anna Pavlovna wished both to rebuke him for daring to speak as he had done of a man recommended to the Empress, and at the same time to console him. So she said, "Now, about your family. Do you know that since your daughter came out, everyone has been enraptured by her? They say she is amazingly beautiful." The prince bowed to signify his respect and gratitude. "I often think," she continued, after a short pause, drawing nearer to the prince and smiling amiably at him, as if to show that political and social topics were ended and the time had come for intimate conversation. "I often think how unfairly sometimes the joys of life are distributed. Why has fate given you two such splendid children? I don't speak of Anatoly, your youngest. I don't like him," she added in a tone admitting of no rejoinder, and raising her eyebrows. "Two such charming children, and you really appreciate them less than anyone. And so you don't deserve to have them." And she smiled her ecstatic smile. "Oh, I can't help it," said the prince. "Lavater would have said I lacked the bump of paternity." "Don't joke. I mean to have a serious talk with you. Do you know I am dissatisfied with your youngest son? Between ourselves," and her face assumed its melancholy expression, "he was mentioned at Her Majesty's, and you were pitied." The prince answered nothing, but she looked at him significantly, awaiting a reply. He frowned. "What would you have me do?" he said at last. "You know I did all a father could for their education, and they have both turned out fools. Hippolyte is at least a quiet fool, but Anatoly is an active one. That is the only difference between them." He said this, smiling, in a way more natural and animated than usual, so that the wrinkles around his mouth very clearly revealed something unexpectedly coarse and unpleasant. "And why are children born to such men as you? If you were not a father, there would be nothing I could reproach you with," said Anna Pavlovna, looking up pensively. "I am your faithful slave. To you alone, I confess that my children are the bane of my life. It is the cross I have to bear. That is how I explain it to myself. It can't be helped." He said no more, but expressed his resignation to cruel fate by a gesture. Anna Pavlovna meditated. "Have you ever thought of marrying your prodigal son, Anatoly?" she asked. "They say old maids have a mania for matchmaking, and though I don't feel that weakness in myself as yet, I know a little person who is very unhappy with her father. She is a relation of yours, Princess Mary Bolkonskaya." Prince Vasily did not reply, though. With the quickness of memory and perception befitting a man of the world, he indicated, by a movement of the head, that he was considering this information. "Do you know," he said at last, evidently unable to check the sad current of his thoughts, "that Anatoly is costing me 40,000 rubles a year? And," he went on, after a pause, "what will it be in 5 years if he goes on like this?" Presently he added, "That's what we fathers have to put up with. Is this princess of yours rich?" "Her father is very rich and stingy. He lives in the country. He is the well-known Prince Bolkonski, who had to retire from the army under the late emperor, and was nicknamed the King of Prussia. He is very clever, but eccentric and a bore. The girl is very unhappy. She has a brother. I think you know him. He married Lisa Minen lately. He is an aide-de-camp of Kutuzov's, and will be here tonight." "Listen, dear Annette," said the prince, suddenly taking Anna Pavlovna's hand and for some reason drawing it downwards. "Arrange that affair for me, and I shall always be your most devoted slave. Slave, with an F, as a village elder of mine writes in his reports. She is rich and of good family, and that's all I want." And, with the familiarity and easy grace peculiar to him, He raised the maid of honour's hand to his lips, kissed it, and swung it to and fro as he lay back in his armchair, looking in another direction. "Attenders," said Anna Pavlovna, reflecting, "I'll speak to Lisa, young Bolkonsky's wife, this very evening, and perhaps the thing can be arranged. It shall be on your family's behalf that I'll start my apprenticeship as old maid."
Okay, well, that's the end of chapter one. How did we go? I quite enjoyed that. A little dance of social chess between these two people. It's quite a lot to unpack, and I'm going to try to build a bit of context around where this is taking place and when this is taking place, because you get the sense that there's some kind of political changes on the horizon.
I guess a good place to start here is with Napoleon, what he's up to. So this chapter takes place in 1805, as it mentions. So by this point, the French Revolution has ended. And during that revolution, Napoleon has sort of risen through the military ranks and emerged as a great leader. So by 1805, at the point where this book starts, he has just sort of boldly declared himself Emperor of France, and he's trying to extend his empire. Now, early in the chapter, there's this character named Novosiltsev, which is mentioned. And that kind of went over my head, so I asked the Reddit community, you know, it mentions Novosiltsev's dispatch, and I don't really know what that is or who that is. And I got a good response here from a Reddit user called Alfimon, and he's quoted the PNV book, a little passage from the PNV edition of War and Peace, and it says, "In 1804 and 1805, England, Russia, Austria, Prussia, Sweden, and the Kingdom of Naples planned to form a coalition against France," so against Napoleon. "Napoleon, learning of this plan, made an offer of peace to England. England asked the Russian Emperor, Alexander I, to mediate in the negotiations. Alexander sent his special emissary, Novosiltsev," that's that character that they're talking about, his dispatch, "sent him to Paris for that purpose." So he's been sent on behalf of Russia to mediate negotiations between France and England. It says, "On reaching Berlin on 15th of June 1805, Novosiltsev learned of Napoleon's taking of Genoa and Lucca." Genoa and Lucca are cities in Italy. And he sent that information in a dispatch to the emperor, and he remained in Berlin. No peace was concluded, and in the fall of 1805, war began between France and the Austrian-Russian coalition." So in this chapter, it's looking like they're about to have some conflict with this French emperor, Napoleon. There's a really cool bit of language where Anna says, "the Hydra of Revolution." And one Reddit user asked why she said that, what does that mean, and how does that translate? So a Hydra is a mythical beast. It symbolizes an enemy, so it's something that must be defeated, and it's an aggressive, it's a hostile enemy. But the thing about a Hydra is when you attack it with force and you chop off its head, it grows more heads and becomes stronger. So it's essentially an enemy that if you attack it in the way that it tempts you to attack it, you actually have the adverse effect and it gets stronger. And I think that's a really cool way to, a cool analogy for a revolution. If you attack a revolution back in the way that it attacks you, you end up just feeding the revolution and it gets stronger. So it's an enemy that requires patience and strategy to beat, rather than just force. So they are on the brink of a war, and that's illustrated as well by this line that Anna says. She says, "Bonaparte has burnt his boats, and I believe that we are ready to burn ours." Now, what's meant by that is to burn one's boats means to commit to a battle. So it comes from something that Alexander the Great did when he landed in Persia. He burnt the boats that they arrived on the shores with rather than leaving them on the shores, which meant that there was no retreat from the battle that they were about to enter into. So what Anna is saying to Prince Vasily is that Napoleon has committed to a war and that they were about to do the same thing. It's about to kick off. Now, I think we should focus on these two characters, Anna and Prince Vasily, starting with Anna. There was a really cool question posed in the Reddit thread, and they said, if you had to sum her up in one word, what would it be? Some of the words were cunning, socialite, smart, busybody, and there was a lot of talk about how her game was sort of social currency. She's a socialite, and her value, her self-worth, is sort of based around the company that she keeps. She throws these soiree parties for high society so that she has a role within high society. Reddit user W. Suazo said, she gets what she wants by using other people, and I think that is what we will see as the book progresses. Some commenters have said that they quite like her and find her sort of light and colourful and entertaining, whereas others have said they found Anna to be a bit hollow and insincere and kind of superficial. Now, Prince Vasily, on the other hand, he's sort of an old hat at this kind of social chess. He belongs in Russian high society, and he's really making an appearance at this party in return for Anna's help in finding his son a bride. That's what he's there to do. He's there sort of begrudgingly, but, you know, he's doing his family duty of finding his son a partner and his daughter a partner too. He does seem a little bit gruff, but I think he's the kind who doesn't suffer fools gladly. And he seems to doubt himself as a father. He says, Lavatar would have said, I lack the bump of paternity. Paternity meaning, you know, the ability to be a father. Now there he's referring to a guy called Johann Caspar Lavatar, who was a Swiss mystic who practiced phrenology. So phrenology is a completely discredited idea. It's a pseudoscience that posits that you can interpret a person's mental capacities by the bumps on their skull. So in this, he's basically saying that there'd be a bump, you know, the good dad bump on his head. And if Lavar assessed him, he'd say that he doesn't have that bump. It's obvious to us now in the modern age that that's ridiculous, that, you know, your mental characteristics are not shown in bumps on your head, but I guess back then they didn't have modern science, so things like that seemed true. It's like a doctor could feel your head and tell you that you don't have the bump of being good at Pictionary, or, you know, you've got the bump of making perfectly al dente pasta. It's quite clearly not true, but that's what he's referencing there. So he's got these doubts about himself as a father, and that's because his two sons both seem to be kind of dim-witted. One of them is outspokenly dim-witted and the other is quietly dim-witted. And he sees himself as a failure of a father because of these two dim-witted sons. I don't really think it's clear yet whether or not he's a good father or a bad father, but he is sort of doing his fatherly duties. Like, it does seem like he's only at this party at the moment to help his son and his daughter, and he's got to go to this other this fate later on that in that same night for his daughter. So he's doing his family duties. Perhaps it's not his fault that his two sons are a bit stupid. That's kind of yet to be revealed. One thing I noticed in this chapter, which I might be completely wrong about, but I'll put this question out to the listeners, and maybe someone with a bit more knowledge than I can either confirm or denounce this. But Anna's talking about a potential match for Prince Vasily's son, and she talks about this this fellow. Let me just find his name really quickly. It's okay. So here it is. It's Prince Bolkonski. That's the father of the unhappy girl that she was saying could be married off to Prince Vasily's youngest son. Now, I had to look up the names and how to pronounce them, and in doing so, I found that she's talking about Prince Andrei Bolkonski, who is the son of Prince Nikolai Bolkonski. And the description it has here of Andrei Bolkonski is that
He's one of the major characters in the novel and is the scion of a wealthy landowning family noted for its military achievements. Bit of a stretch here, but I know that Tolstoy's father was named Nikolai, and I'm quite sure he was a wealthy landowning family and he was noted for his military achievements. So I wonder if there's any correlation between these two between that character, Nikolai Bolkonsky, and Tolstoy's father himself. I suspect that someone will comment and tell me that that is complete nonsense and not the case at all. That connection is just arbitrary in my mind. But, you know, you never know. It might be the case. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the translation of this novel, because quite a lot of this chapter was actually originally in French and then translated into English. And there are editions of this book translated into English that retain the French. Thankfully, mine isn't, because I would absolutely butcher those words if I had to try to speak French. But there is an interesting little thing here to note about the use of language and the use of French. And I'll just read this little excerpt here. Tolstoy himself was an excellent linguist who knew Russian, French, English, Arabic, Hebrew, ancient Greek, and German. Although he was extremely familiar with French, he disliked its widespread adoption in Russian society. When Tolstoy has a character speaking in French, it is an implied sign of insincerity and inauthenticity. Now, Anna does a lot of speaking in French in this chapter, so maybe we are supposed to sort of see her as a very inauthentic person. One thing that I don't really understand about this, and I'm going to put this question out to the Reddit community, is why did they speak French in Russia at this time? It seemed like it was a bit of a chic thing to do, or maybe it was fashionable or something like that. But Anna seems to really put on the French as much as possible. And considering that they're in Russia and that France is sort of the enemy, that seems a little bit, I don't really understand that. It's a bit strange to me. So I'm hoping someone can sort of write in and enlighten me about that, and we'll figure out just why that is the case. Now, because there are so many different translations of this book, there's sort of parts that have been interpreted in different ways, or at least sort of phrased in different ways. And I want to have a look at this this one line. So this is the line in the Maud version as we just read it. Can one be well while suffering morally? Can one be calm in times like these if one has any feeling? And in some of the other translations, that line goes like this. In the Briggs translation, it says, how can one feel well when one is suffering in a moral sense? Can any sensitive person find peace of mind nowadays? So that's interesting. That's much sort of more readable, easier to interpret, I suppose, that translation. The Garnet version of the quote says, how can one help being worried in these times if one has any feeling? Which I thought was kind of cool. That's a different way of saying the same thing again. And in the PNV translation of that line, it says, is it possible to remain at ease in our time if one has any feeling? Out of all those, I think my favorite is probably either the Maud one. I think that's quite good. Although that bit, can one be calm in times like these if one has any feeling, is a little bit kind of vague. It's hard to know the inflection with which she's saying that. And I really like the Briggs one, the sort of simplified one. How can one feel well when one is suffering in a moral sense? Can any sensitive person find peace of mind nowadays? I hope that the Reddit community keeps throwing up these little comparisons of lines like that, because I found that really fascinating to look at the different ways in which these same lines have been translated into English. I think that'll do us for today. We've had a good look at that chapter. We've sort of dived into it into some greater detail and looked at the characters in greater detail. I've had a lot of fun doing this already. This is great. I can't wait to do this every day of this year. Now, I just want to stress that this podcast would not be possible without the Reddit community, A Year of War and Peace. It's through the knowledge that is shared on that subreddit that I have any understanding of chapter one of this book at all. So if you're not part of that community, jump over there and subscribe, because we're reading along together and there's a really good conversation every day about the current chapter. And it's just a really great place to be to participate in this project. And this podcast itself is a community project. So If you have any suggestions or ideas, if you'd like to get involved or maybe be a guest on the podcast, please don't be shy. Please feel welcome to contact me and get involved. Thank you very much for listening to Chapter 1 of A Year of War and Peace, the podcast, and I will see you tomorrow.